And now I am really pleased to have an expert with us on the growth of secularism, and it's kind of the expert, a sociologist who studies it for a living and actually is director of the Institute for the Study of Secularism in Society and Culture at Trinity College. Barry Cosman is a principal researcher of the famous, mentioned by Ron Reagan yesterday, American Religious Identification Survey, 2008, as well as 2001. And many of you know that the 2008 study shows the non-religious as 15% now and growing of the US population, still the fastest growing segment of the population when broken down by religious identification. Barry Cosman also he holds degrees from the Universities of London and McMaster, which is Canada. He has taught internationally. He is a research professor with the Public Policy and Law Program. He's the author of more than 20 books and research monographs and the editor of several books on secularism in relation to science, society, and women, which are available at this convention, and he will be signing books at the end of the session. He has taught at universities in Europe, Africa, and North America. And prior to coming to Trinity, he was on the faculty of the PhD program in sociology, CUNY Graduate School, and was a visiting professor at the University of Cape Town and University College Chichester, I'm not saying that right, Chester, in the UK. Professor Cosman told me he doesn't accept many non-academic speaking engagements, so we feel really fortunate to have him here today to talk about the fascinating finds of the 2008 ARIS study and his other studies on secularism. So where are you?
Well, thank you, Annie Laurie, friends. That was a wonderful introduction. Were the spirit of my grandmother possible, I'm sure she could have written the same. I would like to thank Annie Laurie and Dan and the Foundation for inviting me here. It's a delight. And I really enjoyed the sessions last night. And it's always good to learn something about your audience. I get to know you. I learned you enjoy comedy, having a laugh. You like to eat cake. Sing old German songs. And seem very keen on maintaining, like many tribes, your oral tradition. Now, as you know, I spent the last 20 years researching the worldviews and religious identification of the American public, began in Time Series in 1990. And as a result, I'm, you know, probably unique in this room in where I get invited. Last week, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, not to sing at the Grand Ole Opry, but to give a public lecture at Vanderbilt University, and it was sponsored in part by their Divinity School. So being a kind of objective social scientist, I'm going to give you exactly the same speech as last time. The only difference is it's like word alterations. So you will laugh and cry in the correct places according to your ideology. So this time, everything that was half full in Nashville will be half empty in Seattle. So let me get down to business. In March this year, we released the summary report of the American Religious Identification Survey. And it was fashionable and widely accepted common knowledge before that in the academia, the media, political pundits, or everybody, that we lived in, through an era, or we were living through an era of faith, and that the zeitgeist and the general ethos in the US favored religion. Now, all of this material, as you know, is available, download free of charge, from websites. I've even got a few handouts to give you on some of the report, the highlights of it, if anybody wants them afterwards. So everything I'm telling you is, you'll be delighted to know, is evidence-based. So we were told that Americans have gotten very religious in recent years, and apart from the Saudis and the Indians, Americans were really leading the field in this arena. That's not to say that the reaction to the findings in March wasn't a bit hysterical. I think most of you saw the cover of Newsweek in April 14, the decline and fall of Christian America. Going from 86 to 76% Christian is not exactly the decline and fall. Even even the Roman Empire did better than that. But fortunately, most of the reportage and analysis has been pretty good and balanced and objective. So my chosen task here, of course, is to disabuse you of the idea that secularization was dormant in the U.S. Until we proclaimed the rise of the nones, the nones, by revealing that one in five Americans do not identify with a religious group. And one caveat emptor, as any surveys you see, is not only the 15%, but the 5% who refuse to answer any questions about religion have got to be put into the picture here. And they're asked a very simple question, which we've done for the last 20 years: what is your religion, if any? And that had gone up from 8% to 14% in 2001. 2008 showed 15%, now 34 million people. But somehow the zeitgeist was with us, to the extent that what was no news in 2001 seemed to be very, very popular in 2009. So this irreligious population is growing at about 750,000 people a year. What we think of as organized religion, of course, is less popular, and that tends to be seen increasingly by Americans as the religious right. And I would like to show you that I don't think it's actually been on the march for the last few years. And I provide a counter argument to the idea that America has become much more evangelical. Now, the social facts show that in what we might call the three B's, as we talk it, belief, belonging, and behavior, the average American has become much less religious over the past two or three decades, and has become more secular. The secularizing trend has not only affected public sentiment, but also law, the economy, education, family life, despite the valiant but largely ineffective effects of many conservative clerics and Republican politicians to hold back this tide. With hindsight, we can observe from 2009 at least that the Christian right failed to make its desired impact in most of these areas according to its own agenda. In terms of the nation's moral health, according to their view. In retrospect, our survey shows, if you have a time series, that it was the 1990s that were a time of a very big secular boom in this country. The non-religious population, which is rising about 750,000 a year now, was rising at nearly 1.3 million a year at that time, people declining to be religious or give a religious identification. And the measures all pointed in one direction. So that's not surprising from a kind of sociological point of view. The 1990s was a period of prosperity, with a corresponding emphasis on consumerism and materialism as a result of the peace dividend at the end of the Cold War. If one accepts the old adage that religion is for the poor and the fearful, opium of the masses, according to Uncle Carl, then one theory for the loosening of the hold of religion, particularly among young Americans, is that in a period of national security, it's interesting, the money that we see at the back there, what was the year it was changed? 1957, Cold War. So there's some logic to my argument here. Particularly among young Americans, the period of national security and prosperity was an ideal environment for the rise of individualism and its correlate, secularity. Though the rhetoric of American politics and public life did indeed change after 1976, and there was more God talk, the actual situation in law on the ground in society has not really mirrored this change. In fact, in the course of the culture war, the reversals suffered by traditional religion and its claims have been manifold. There's been a measurable decline in religiosity, in religion's impact in the economic and social sphere, which is not unexpected, given the fact that the intellectual elite, and much as I'll show of the business elite, never subscribed to the agenda of the religious right. Key indicators of belief, belonging, and behavior, such as identification of with religion, membership of congregations, attendance at religious worship on the weekend, have all declined. Today, half the households in the United States do not belong to a religious congregation. On the average Sunday, according to time diaries kept by the Bureau of Labor, 73% of Americans do not go to church. 27% of Americans do not anticipate a religious funeral. 30% of Americans do not believe in the biblical-style God. The Sunday laws and restrictions on gambling have been abolished in most states. Abortion, contraception, and pornography actually are available most places. Euthanasia and assisted suicide have been endorsed by the courts in this part of the world. And prayer in public school remains banned. Homosexuality is no longer a crime and is largely accommodated in law and society. Civil unions of same-sex couples are now recognized in several states. And as we know, same-sex marriage has been legislated into law in New England states this year. I'll talk a little bit more about Maine in a minute. At the outset, I would like to offer an explanation why so many sensible and observant people in the media and the intelligentsia misinterpreted the evidence around them for the rise of secularity. One reason is that they are oriented to party politics and focused on the electoral process, not society itself. This, as I shall demonstrate, is the main area where religion has had a real impact. The reason for this is that in the 1970s, the centers of gravity within American Protestantism shifted from the more liberal mainline, or now sometimes called old line denominations, whose adherents dominated the levers of power and government since really the revolution. That was lost, and it was taken by more conservative, fundamentalist, and evangelical denominations. In recent decades, the connection between frequent religious service attendance and political, social, and religious conservatism became increasingly tight. In some cases, it's grown tighter because most religiously active people have become more conservative over time. That concentration began to intensify in the 1970s, and it continues. This produced the so-called culture wars phenomenon of the 1990s, which, in fact, produced the secularity that you're benefiting from. Another trend in the congregational organization of American religion also played its part. These types of denominations and what was known as the church growth movement increased the number of very large churches across the country. This trend occurred in nearly every Protestant denomination on which we have data, and it resulted in increasing concentration of churchgoers within very large churches. The new phenomenon, especially in the increasingly electoral powerful Sunbelt states, was the megachurch and its impressive facilities, broad array of social and recreational activities, often led by a politically and media-savvy, conservative, charismatic preacher. Megachurches were the natural home of the new brand label, non-denominational Christians, whose numbers we recorded in 1990 as 200,000 people, and in 2008 as over 8 million. Pastors who could mobilize large numbers of congregants often became powerful political actors in the local media and political scene, especially where they were linked to national organizations. These religious entrepreneurs were expert exponents of supply-side religion. These trends, combined with an increasing affiliation among Protestants with these conservative and evangelical denominations, resulted in an increasing public presence, social prominence, and political influence for American religion. But really, it was evangelical and conservative Protestantism, not American religion, which comes in a wide variety of types, and you might say a wide variety of sin. This is the social reality behind and in part created by the rise of the religious right in recent decades. A development's tremendously increased religion's visibility in politics at every level. So that they're correct about. The result, as my co-author and Ariel Onkay-Zion pointed out in a book we put out. First book I wrote about American religion was Religion, One Nation Under God, which was written in 1991, I guess, and it could have been written in 1921. The second book in 2001 was called Religion in a Free Market, and it was a, you know, an assumption that economics and some of these things were changing. The new one haven't got a title for it yet. But what it showed was the 2006 book showed an increasingly tight connection between this religiosity and political and social conservatism. And for the first time, there was a real religious divide, a God gap, between the political parties. Two constituencies, really, were forming. It was the power and influence of the religious right in the Republican Party that led many observers to claim that the recent decades are ones of religious revival, awakening, or revitalization for all Americans. The energy and innovation, and we have to accept that, of the evangelicals and fundamentalists allowed them also to successfully appropriate the terms Christian and even religious, right? What is a Christian school, right? It's not for Catholics. They operated very efficient public relations direct mail fundraising organizations linked to televangelism in the 1980s and 90s. This religious entrepreneurialism had a strong short-term success in dominating the debate on many domestic and economic agenda items in the public square through interests, you know, those interest groups that you all know about, moral majority, focus on the family. But the long-term effect was to produce a reaction against the judgmentalism of the religious right, particularly among women and the generations X and Y, which created the increased secularity in society that's now becoming evident. Nevertheless, we have to admit that in 2008, our figures show, and I don't think anybody can deny it, one out of every three Americans thinks they are born again or evangelical. Right? Self-certified born again with a personal relationship with Jesus. These evangelicals were also able to dominate the political debate because of a greater diffidence among the largest American religious group, which is the Catholic Church, to enter the arena of electoral politics to some extent, other than on abortion and sex stuff. Catholic community is literally a much broader church, less politically and socially cohesive. It's divided between liberals and conservatives, culture and what you might call practicing Catholics. But the Catholic population has been eroded by defections, particularly among the young and middle-aged and white males since 1990, which reduced its political clout, and those people have been replaced by poor Latinos, which haven't got the same amount. So the decline and also the decline in the prestige of the Catholic Church is particularly, where I come from, New England, where the proportion of Catholics between 1990 and 2008 fell from 50% of the population of those six states to 33%, is very important. Sociological trends played their part, but an anti-clerical reaction to the sexual scandals among the priesthood was obvious, and the bad publicity continues. Now, I want to also point out to you that 80% of the victims were male, right? Now, this has to be factored into the whole attitude of some of these new nuns, as we would call them, towards homosexuality. The Boston Archdiocese alone shuttered 60 churches, paid out $85 million in compensation in 2002-2003, financial year. The trials and tribulations of the Catholic Church have not ended. Report in March 2009 by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops showed 803 allegations were filed by 706 victims in 2008 against 518 clergy. The Church spent more than $436 million in legal settlements, attorney fees, and counseling costs. That's a lot of collection plates, friends. The Catholic Church lost 17% of its adherents, according to our figures, between childhood and adulthood. We asked people what they were age 12, what they are today. 17% of the Catholics voted with their feet. The main result of all this is, of course, secularization of a type. We found that, latest, 35% of all the new nuns are former Catholics. And 35% of all the nuns claim some kind of Irish heritage of some kind. Now, the revolt of the laity has reached historic proportions in Connecticut. In March 2009, there was legislation before the state assembly, since withdrawn after death threats to two of the assemblymen, to take the administration and governance of the church out of the hands of the clergy and hierarchy. This attempt was not just about the sex scandals. It was a response to several cases of theft, large-scale theft of funds by priests. Finally, it is necessary to point out that many on the left of the intellectual and political spectrum also have done their best to enhance the salience of religion. Antagonism to modernity, enlightenment values, and science, led by postmodernists, multiculturalists in academe, to valorize and exaggerate religious diversity and ethnic particularism, have resulted, and resulting from the immigration from the developing world, which is all very nice, but one would never learn from these studies that the total of all the non-Christian religious groups in the United States is less than 4% of the population. And that the challenge to the supremacy of Christianity in this country comes not from other world religions, but from or new religious movements even, but from irreligion. Studies of new immigrants have been funded by the Templeton, the Lilly, the Luce, the Melton, the Carnegie, and Ford Foundations. They've all tended to emphasize the religiosity and the difference, as well as to overstate the numerical contribution of Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Santeria, Rastafarianism, etc., to the American religious landscape. The fact that by far the largest religious group among Asians is nuns, 27%, and that Hispanics without a religious identity outnumber Latino Pentecostals by a factor of 4-1 has been ignored and even hidden by an intellectual and ideological outlook fascinated with the exotic that seems to mimic in some ways Victorian anthropological essentialism. Now, this school of scholars also tends to ignore the many immigrants to the United States, attracted not by its guarantee of religious freedom or religious liberty, but by the possibility it offers for freedom from religion. This is especially true for secular and democratically oriented people from the Middle East and Asia, seeking to escape from the restrictions of Sharia law, Muslim fundamentalist persecution, and Islamist violence. So those are the kind of factors that have made us feel there's much more religion out there than we think. And another area of religion of major interest, the religious right, and now I find to you guys as well, sexuality, marriage and abortion, their agenda failed to progress during their supposed political ascendance in the 1980s and 90s. And since then, they've lost some ground. I won't talk about Roe and Wade, but it's never been reversed, despite lots of effort. And more importantly, the secularization of the family has advanced. Initially, as I said, civil unions, and now gay marriage equality itself. Now, marriage and matrimony, of course, are terms that were once reserved for holy wedlock and regarded as a sacrament, by one church at least. Recently, marriage has been redefined by the courts in Massachusetts and Connecticut and Iowa, as we know, to allow homosexual unions. Elsewhere, it tends to be a conflict between two views of liberty, human rights and the power of popular sovereignty to reinforce religious strictures. Increased secularity has meant that this battle has moved away from legal elites, and interestingly, into legislatures, and now, as we've seen, into public, the people's sovereignty to the extent in referenda. It was probably a good thing. Congress, of course, passed the Defense of Marriage Act, and 30 states have passed constitutional amendments, in effect banning homosexual marriage. And we all know that Proposition 8 passed in California, similar measures in Florida and Arkansas in 2008. But in Vermont, as we know, the most irreligious state in the Union, a plurality of people who say they have no religion, nuns, 34% of the population. And as we heard last night, pretty safe and well-organized place to live. A gay marriage bill passed the Senate and the House and even overturned the veto of the government. In New Hampshire, nuns are 29%. Legislation also passed. Interestingly, and this is an interesting point, because nuns are the most male group of all the religious groups or irreligious groups in the country. It's a 60-40 gap. Most religious groups are about 55% female. This group is about 40% female. It's quite a good cross-section here. New Hampshire State Senate is the only legislature in the country with a majority of women members. But they passed this marriage equality bill. And I'm sure some of you in the gay community especially are a bit upset by what happened in Maine. But to me, the fact that a rural state with two Republican senators, 47% of the population, would vote for marriage equality, had I told you this 10 years ago, you would have thought it was nirvana. So you have to, you know, put this into perspective. And as I say, given that 25% of those under 30 are nuns, roughly, this is where obviously the you know, states are headed if the sentiment of the public sentiment of the time remains. I've said quite publicly it's a standoff between young people with a tremendous sympathy for civil rights and what appears to be what appears from the other side, an older generation with much more adherence to biblical injunctions on the basis of what they're told by their clergy. And the civil rights argument is making the public inroad. Now, organized religionists traditionally place great emphasis on control and supervision of marriage and support for the traditional notion of the family, often a patriarchal family. Significantly, marriage as an institution has been eroded in societal significance in recent decades. Rates of divorce, as you know, increased rapidly in the 1960s, and then they tend to flatten off, paradoxically, because of a decline in the number and the rate of marriage itself. Young adults tended to postpone marriage or abandon interest in it entirely. Marriage as an institution lost its monopoly on sex and procreation. The number of single people living with a partner and the rate of non-marital parenting, the number of children born out of wedlock, has increased annually for decades, reached 37% of all live births in 2005. Religion has lost ground as a result of these trends. Decline in church membership and worship among young adults can be traced back to the decline in the rate of marriage. It correlates pretty well. And its delay, or the delay of marriage, which has caused a rise in the age of marriage and those who eventually enter into it. This trend increases, as I said, the measures of secularity. What we see here is that, young families not having children and waiting for children where they're more mature, less grandparent influence, it's a kind of cycle in which they're less likely to get connected religious congregations. But interestingly, the monopoly of what we might call, in many areas, of early childhood education by religious congregations is a factor in affiliating young families to religion in some kind of way. Something to put into your agenda, I guess. So we've seen this advance in what I'm trying to show is the link between institutional secularism and secularity among the population and the loop that's created that reinforces secularization as a general trend in society. Another important factor that most of you don't probably think about a great deal that's made strides for secularity in society at the expense of religion is the fate of laws restricting Sunday activities. America has long been envisioned as a nation that observes and preserves Sunday as sacred time, protected from what they might call the mundane and the profane. Now, this normative American Sunday emerged from the Puritan notion of the Christian Sabbath, inspired, I must remind you, by the fourth of the Ten Commandments, because you haven't got them written up on the wall here for me to, you know, point to. So what that meant was the exclusion of economic production in the marketplace and the avoidance, actually, of most forms of pleasurable consumption on Sundays. Saturday if you're Jewish. First Sunday law was enacted in Virginia as early as 1610. It required church attendance for everybody, except Indians, prescribing the death penalty for third-time offenders. Penalties for sins of omission and commission were clearly laid out under similar laws in the New Haven colony. They waited to 1656 to really get the death penalty organized. To protect the sacred time, the profane was defined not only as the commercial, but also avoidance of amusement, devoid of an uplifting message. Exhilaration through inebriation, correctly viewed as the antithesis of Puritan sobriety and austerity. They couldn't ban it for this sort of six, we might call secular days of the week, but at least one day would be kept pure. So these Bible-inspired laws forbidding numerous activities, the blue laws, were brought in. And they formalized what became known as the Puritan Sabbath, a day of rest, worship, and sobriety in every sense. This complex of normative Sunday behaviors marked the young American Republic. So behoves me to talk about de Tocqueville here and tell you, give a few words from an eyewitness account by that intrepid Frenchman in 1831. He's in a large American city, which I think is Chicago. All social movement begins to be suspended even on Saturday evenings. Not only have all ceased to work, but they appear to have ceased to exist. You can hear neither the movements of industry nor the accents of joy, nor even the confused murmur that arises from the midst of a great city. The description makes clear that Sunday, the day of rest and the Lord's Day, started on Saturday night and extended until Monday morning, creating in reality a unique sacred time space, lasted about 36 hours. H.L. Mencken of Baltimore, as you remember, lived at the tail end of this, and he described the American Sunday as a day given over by Americans to wishing that they themselves were dead and in heaven. And that their neighbors were dead and in hell. It was just after this period that there was a big change, and that was actually due to baseball. Athletic competition on a Sunday was allowed. In 1934, Sunday baseball was introduced. And the growing influence of major sports corporations in the transformation of Sunday is best expressed, of course, in the history of the Super Bowl. Played on a Sunday since 1967, and now widely recognized as a national secular holiday. Of course, the elimination of Sunday laws has been a gradual and complex process. 1872, California became the first state to abolish all restrictions on Sunday business. In 1961, however, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on four Sunday law cases. Majority headed by Chief Justice Earl Warren upheld them, ruling that such laws do not interfere with the free exercise of religion, do not constitute the establishment of a state religion, and serve the purpose of providing a day of rest for all. These decisions caused both surprise and criticism at the time and proved the special status of Sunday laws. But paradoxically, these affirmative rulings also marked the beginning of the end for these laws. After 1960, the forces of individualism and consumerism, which operated to eliminate Sunday laws, gained much strength. With the accelerated pace of opposition to and elimination of these Sunday laws, religious leaders of all Christian denominations were speaking out against the new trend, with no visible impact. During the decades of the 50s and 60s, four states repealed them. In the 1970s, seven more states. 1980s and 90s, six more states have followed suit. These included Bible Belt states, North Dakota, Tennessee, and Texas. Currently before the legislature in my home state of Connecticut are measures to eradicate the last vestiges of the Puritan colonial legislation for Sunday. There's a Republican measure to end the ban on Sunday hunting. and a democratic bill to abolish the ban on alcohol sales. Now, this is presumably consensus politics at work. A national consensus that Sunday requires more guns and liquor and presumably less prayer, I'm sure you're all in favour of. But, you know, this last, if you think about it, those bans on liquor is the last vestige of the once powerful temperance movement that dominated this country in the first decades of the 20th century, and especially was led by the powerful Protestant churches that created prohibition. There's been, as I say, a coalition of forces fighting for the preservation of the Sunday, mostly of this variety of religious bodies. But the coalition fighting to secularize Sunday has been the most visible, the most powerful, made up of the business organizations and secular individuals, the consumers. So the history of these struggles illustrates another step in the secularization of the country. It's a process of the devaluing of religious ideas and the devaluing and the erosion of religious authority, whereby religious authority becomes marginalized. Seems the secular activities of shopping and entertainment on Saturday have actually invaded Sunday space. The culture of the automobile, which changed every aspect of modern life, changed most aspects of work and leisure. Many Christians thought it was a good thing, get people to church more easily, but they go other places instead. Now, does it have any behavioral effects, this change in blue laws? Actually, a couple of economists, Gruber and Hungerman, followed the repeal of state laws. They said that attendance falls, as soon as you repeal the state law, the blue laws, 5% fall in church attendance. 15% of those who'd be attending religious services weekly begin to attend less frequently. Donations to religious organizations fall by 13%, or about $109 a year. Spending by religious organizations in those states falls 6%. So the elimination of blue laws has meant that the prescribed religious nature of the day was no longer supported and has real effects and in real time. The religion no longer has a monopoly over your time and what you do. And so therefore the church has to compete for people's time and mind. And that's why we wrote religion in a free market, because the economy is very important in this area. So the pressure for cultural differentiation obviously has grown. And it comes from the secular forces, economic and symbolic. So really, Sunday, the Lord's Day, right, where all of you could be executed, presumably all of you have missed three churches in the last 3 weeks. Wait, in Virginia, 300 years ago, you're lucky people. Now you have a mixed-use day combining work, worship, I'm sure not, but entertainment, if you know, certainly. Now, let me turn to another important issue, which I think is of some economic importance, and that's gambling, right? The founder of the social gospel movement, the Baptist minister Walter Rauschenbusch, around 1990, wrote a book called Christianity in the Social Crisis. He described gambling as the vice of the savage. A true civilization ought to outgrow it, as it has, listen to this, tattooing and cannibalism. I'm sure there's some tattooed people here. I hope there are no cannibals. Seattle must be a vegan center. Now, Billy Sunday also opposed gambling, and it was forbidden to his followers. This was a period, actually, when the religious right, what we consider the evangelical churches, were actually nurtured strong anti-capitalist sentiments. The Cross of Gold speech and all that kind of stuff, Jennings Bryan. They oppose gambling, of course, because greed is one of the seven deadly sins. That's another thing you ought to have up on the wall. As well as an addiction, it's a regressive tax on poor people, and a habit that causes family breakup and destroys all those good marriages and things. So what happened? In the years since 1900, in 1964, in fact, only one state, New Hampshire, had a lottery, state lottery. They now operate in 41 states and the District of Columbia. 40 years ago, only one state, Nevada, had a casino. Now 10 states have casinos. 11 have racetrack betting. It's estimated that one in four Americans visited a casino in 2006, probably a lot of them on a Sunday. Now, interestingly, in 1997, the Southern Baptist Convention, at the height of its power and influence, passed a resolution that Christians, quote, should refuse to participate or promote gambling. And they called on politicians to prohibit gambling and its advertisement. Yet no national religious movement of opposition to gambling emerged. Opposition went the way of gambling went the way of prohibition. The religious right failed completely in this particular moral crusade. The SBC's only success against gambling was in Alabama, where casinos were defeated by their religious opposition. So that's to tell you something about, you know, the times we live in and the forces out there and who's powerful in politics and economics. So having illustrated the trends towards secularization in the realms of what you might call belonging and behavior, I now want to talk about the third B of religiosity belief. There's been an erosion in the underlying levels of religious belief of Americans in the last few decades. Key indicators are erosion in the belief in an inerrant Bible, reduced confidence in religious organizations and leaders, and reduced tolerance of certain kinds of religious involvement in the public sphere. This is according to public opinion polls. Our own survey in 2008 revealed that 70% of Americans only, as I say, subscribe to this biblical personal God. This is much lower than earlier surveys, most of which are skewed to include practically anything as belief in God. So we have a more nuanced nature of responses. So we offered a kind of deist, neo-pagan, higher power, I guess Hindu, higher power answer. 12% of Americans subscribe to that. Not you folks, but the higher power, you know, or forces with you. Agnostics, 10%. And atheist theological response categories covered 2%. So the atheists and the agnostics are about 12% of the American population Bible answers to a theological question. What is interesting here is that theological questions reveal much greater numbers of atheists and agnostics than do straight questions on self-identification, either an indirect one, what is your belief in any, if any, or are you atheist or agnostic? And it's probably important for you to realize that most of your allies amongst the nuns, and the majority of the nuns, are in fact the religiously indifferent, the what we might call the religiously unmusical folks like myself. The General Social Survey of recent years provides supporting evidence that both illustrates and explains these data. GSS has shown a decline in the proportion, as I said, of public who have great confidence in organized religion from 32% in 1976 to 20% in 2008. The American public now expresses as low a degree of confidence in religious leaders as they do in the leaders of other major institutions. There's some satisfaction in that. The percentage agreeing strongly that religious leaders should not try to influence government decisions increased from 22 to 31%. By 1998, from in that decade of the 1990s. More recently, according to Gallup, the percentage of people who agreed that organized religion should have less influence in this nation increased between 2001 and 2008 from 22% to 34% of the population. So all these numbers are in the, if you think about it, the kind of anti-theist, anti-religious right kind of people, are somewhere between 15% and a third of the population. That is the kind of constituency of the skeptics. Now, the interrelationship of belief and behavior plays out a number of ways. We've discovered we were the first people to ask, do you want a religious funeral? It's interesting that nobody ever thought that would be open to question before. And we've discovered that 27% of Americans are not interested in one. Since religion traditionally, historically, anthropologically, has been about death concerns of mortality. It's placed tremendous emphasis on providing a gateway to salvation and the underlife, and the afterlife, not the underlife. It's kind of Freudian slip there, but you know what I mean. You have a choice. It's, you know, the 27% is another indicator of America's lack of attachment to religion, growing lack of attachment. The percentage of people who never attend a religious service, never, it's different to the people who don't go on the average Sunday, by the way, has increased slightly. It was 13% in 1990, people who wouldn't darken the doors of a church, has increased to 23% now. A gradual but steady decline, as I said, in inerrant belief in the Bible is underway. The percentages who say they believe the Bible is the actual word of God and to be taken literally has decreased. It's decreased particularly amongst young people. Might be due to education or something else. However, results, other recent social surveys, of course, indicating this greater secularity, there are interesting signs of public interest in topics you guys are interested in, which is secularism, atheism, irreligion, more books on Darwin, et cetera, more blogs, phenomenal amount of blog space on what you might call the non-theistic ideas, more institutions, more discussion about non-religion or secularity of various forms. Now, the salience of religious strictures and practices in the lives of people most clearly has diminished, I would suggest, the evidence I've given you, over the last two decades. Now, that does not mean that organized religion will vanish. Religion is a commodity far too valuable in every sense of the word to many of its purveyors for that to happen. In fact, a counterattack on freethinkers and nuns is actually already beginning. Now, last week I did attend an academic lecture by Professor Robert Putnam of Harvard, famous for bawling alone. Right? Remember that book? Sold millions. His new project, which I predict will be a blockbuster, is entitled, listen to this, American Grace: How Religion is Reshaping Our Civic and Political Lives. I took notes, so listen carefully. According to the sage of Harvard, half the nation's social capital comes today from religion. Admittedly, religious people tend to be more Republican and conservative and less tolerant than others. But according to Putnam, religious Americans are happier and better citizens on practically everything every kind of variable he can think of. They are, quote, more generous, volunteer more, better neighbors, more civically engaged. He also claims that given a choice between religious liberals and secular liberals, or you might call religious humanists and secular humanists, the religious always come out on top in any of these particular things. Participation is the key to this, i.e. attending services. Another quote, having friends is good, having church friends is very good. And this last really academic point, really evidence-based, church friends make you nicer. America's grace is that Americans are very religious, which makes them nicer. All right, so I've given you a heads up to what you're going to see in the next beginning spring next 2010, just in time for the second coming, presumably. Nevertheless, I believe the zeitgeist, if not the force, is actually with the nuns. Despite the rearguard efforts, and they're very well funded, of Putnam, Templeton, and the other religious groups, the secularization in America has, I think, occurred, is occurring, and will continue to occur as the authority of religion and the clergy continues to decline in our society, often with their own assistance rather than yours. Thank you. Well, whatever you like. I'm here now.
If there are
and it's wet outside.
There's time for about 10 minutes.
Sure.
First of all, welcome and thank you for coming and speaking with us. You keep mentioning about the nuns and how many of them in number are young. And we know from voting trends that the young vote in very disproportionate numbers, very low. Have you done any work or speculated at all on as these nuns, these younger nuns, move up into voting populations, what effects that will have on our policies?
Well, you know, despite all the evidence, I'm not a prophet. So what we do know is, look, I mean, you want to know about politics of the nuns, and I've got these things here. Some of you, I've got not enough for all the audience, but hand out the highlights to tell you. The majority of the nuns, it's interesting, nuns are 41% a plurality of independents in terms of political party, right? They tend to be about 10 points lower in voter registration than Putnam's people. They're just less politically inclined. They're not joiners, right? If you know, they don't trust political parties, they don't trust clergy. I mean, they just, you know, institutions are not a thing. You know, it's herding cats with this population. And it's added to by the fact that young people are increasingly, you know, walking around with their own little machines and on their own. And that, you know, living in their own bubble. And that has a political effect. So they, you know, part of it, we don't know what will happen. But the general trend is low turnouts. And will they get it? You know, if there's a real issue, they'll get out and vote, I guess. But I think it is a problem. It is an issue for you folks to think about how mobilizing young people, mobilizing young people of anything other than, you know, sort of American Idol, is difficult. Yes, sir.
Oh, I was. It's a kind of a personal interest. I finished reading a book called American Theocracy. It's by Kevin Phillips. I was just wondering if you've read it and the author, and if you could comment on his work, especially the first part of the book, if you've read it.
No, I skimmed it, and so therefore I don't think I'm very good at giving you the thing. It's a good book, though, isn't it?
It is. It's fabulous, yeah. But a lot of the details and information you're giving were, I guess, some of that information.
All our information is public use data.
Yeah.
So, you know, people use it, and I'm glad to see that.
Great. Thank you.
Over here?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Hi.
There's a left as well as a right in this building.
Yes, there is. I mean, we all seem to be rejoicing about the leaps and bounds that we seem to be taking as a secular nation, or going towards a secular nation, but in this last decade. But should we or should we not be attributing that to the last administration with George Bush? It seems to me like a lot of people have turned against the religiosity because of the Bush that we had in the office. Or...
Well, you know, to some extent, before I looked at the data, I agreed with your prejudice. But the fact is that the 1990s was the period of a great secular boom. 1.3 million people losing their religion every year is against 750,000 a year now. Still, you know, from your point of view, a gain, isn't it? And it will add to the number of voters, of course. But it was the 1990s. I mean, there's an old thing, you know, I went to the University of London. I remember there was a famous old professor who used to teach us there, and he used to talk about, you know, socialism and other disgusting things. But one of the things he said was, you know, socialism could only be afforded in rich countries like New Zealand and Sweden and Denmark and places like that. And to some extent, we're talking about the same thing, that in fact, as I tried to point out, as the French call it, insécurité, is not good for you people. I mean, it really is. You need sovereign consumers, individuals who are confident and not fearful, people who, and a prosperous country, rather than, you know, I mean, we know, as I say, the religion is, you know, for poor people often. So actually, the 90s was a better time, actually. But you get that, you know, there's a historical lag. The people who change their kind of beliefs, they change their behavior in the 90s, then they change their beliefs a little later And now they've even changed their identification, right? Their belonging. So there's a kind of, there's three trajectories there. It's staggered. And so you're picking up the benefits of something actually occurred 10 to 15 years ago. Yeah, a question from the right.
Actually, the left from my side.
It's always good to be put down, of course.
My apologies.
Very good for the soul if I had one.
You reference a number of surveys and studies,
yeah.
a lot of percentages, and since it's not socially popular to be irreligious in America, and a lot of people feel still there's a stigma to attach to that, how accurate do you think your surveys and numbers are? Are people being honest when they respond to these type of questions?
Well, I try to make the distinction between, I mean, I said, let's take the term atheist, which is one that's popular here but nowhere else. There's about a million Americans that if you really push them, if you ask them a question, we'll answer in that way. But as I said, the proportion of people who will tell, if you ask them, does God exist, they'll say no, is about double that, right? So it is, there's a problem with labeling. Now, to some extent, all you progressives in the room can blame a man called John Locke for this, right? His famous book on toleration meant he was tolerant for everybody except atheists, as you know. And that's a strong political tradition in the United States. There is that. But so there is some undercounts of these things. And that's why I spoke about this 5% of people who refuse. They may be in your camp, as well as, you know, so crazily religious that none of the particular ones at the moment appeal to them. So you don't really know. But I think there is a penumbra there. Yes, sir.
I don't want a prediction, but is there an indicator of, from these statistics you're giving, of when it's going to be safe for many of these people to say in their community that I am an atheist?
Well, it depends where you are. Yeah, I mean, you know, sort of, if you shout fire in a theater or in an atheist in a church, you might get in problems. But, you know, college campuses, thing. You're safer amongst men than women, younger people than others, probably in New England and the Pacific Northwest and other places. So I think there are areas in the country now where I don't think it's an issue. I mean, to any great extent. We actually asked, and we haven't released this data yet, one of the things we asked what we called a silo, a proportion of a nationally representative number of people who said they were none, and we asked them if they had been discriminated against. And the people who've been discriminated against, people who come out, but they weren't being discriminated. We asked about the military, business, schools, and things like that. They had no problem. Where were they having problems? In friendship groups and with their family, right? Family. Because actually, most of you would, I can't really tell. I mean, you don't have horns or particular uniforms and things like that. So I really don't know if you were walking down the street, I wouldn't know who to mug or attack or, you know. So that's an issue. I mean, that's what helps, but on the other side, it doesn't. If you are militantly atheist, especially to your grandmother on her way to mass, probably, you know, she's going to cut you out the will. But, you know, but I don't think it's such a problem so much anymore. It's going in the direction you would like. This is a much more tolerant society than it was 30, 40 years ago. Young people increasingly are less judgmental and more tolerant. And as larger numbers of kids get, you know, diversity education in schools and colleges, it's going in that direction. So I think it's going to change. It's going to take a long time because, you know, sort of, it's not going to go. And you probably are going to feel it more, as I said, you know, socially, than you've got a lot of legal protections now, which is important. Thank you. Yeah, I'll be here the rest of the day.